It is just past 8:33. You're listening to Community Radio KGNU, Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins. And we continue with our ongoing series looking at end-of-life issues. And today we're going to take a look at the LGBTQ community and its specific issues around end-of-life. My co-host, as always, is Kim Mooney. Kim, what's the specific title that you are? It's a word I hadn't actually heard of until recently.
A thanatologist.
And what exactly is a thanatologist?
A thanatologist is someone who studies death and dying.
Kim does a lot of workshops in the community. She has a long history of work with hospice care, and her website is practically-dying.com, which we're linking to at kgnu.org. Kim, why did you pick today's topic?
You know, it's important, I think. It's also really timely. There were three things that I thought about. One is that there are distinct issues for the gay population, the lesbian population, bisexuals, but we wanted to do an overview of what it was like to be part of the non-dominant culture. And honestly, I've always wondered about this. If sex wasn't involved, the idea of sex, would this be so loaded? You know, when I grew up, queers were queers. And we weren't really prejudiced, we just called them queers. You know, I think I knew one lesbian, and all we knew is she had very, very short hair. But when my brother finally came out, we were so relieved because he was so secretive. We thought he was smuggling children across the border, you know, working on the overthrow of the government. We had no idea. So it was such a relief. So I kind of was in that transitional generation. And today there is so much more, you know, education. It's not that more people are out. It's become really part of the medical system to become culturally sensitive. So there are a couple things that I realized is that when you work with the white culture and the fact that we don't realize that we're in a white culture, there are a lot of pieces to it, like assuming that we will be liked, assuming that we will be accepted, assuming that we can be a little bit pushy if we want. And that's not true in any of the non-dominant cultures. So the same is true here. When you see a gay person, we make a lot of assumptions in Boulder County. We're pretty liberal, but there are lots of places where gay people are still very threatened, especially in this administration. And I think part of that cultural sensitivity is understanding that we don't understand a lot about the culture. In one study in England, 57% of healthcare workers said, we don't have any issues with gay people. Their healthcare is no different than anybody else's, when in fact it's dramatically different, and particularly at end of life. This is a time of, for everyone, of intense vulnerability. It's a time when the tasks of dying are to reconcile your life, are to say goodbye, are to, you know, go through forgiveness. All of those are special challenges to the gay community, and I think that that's why it's really important. We were working in end of life. We want everybody to have a good ending.
And I know today we're also going to talk about transgender community as well and issues that pertain to them, because that's a whole other specific area that we all need to have more competency around. But specifically, as we are talking about the medical community and the end of life issues as well. Well, we have two excellent guests in the studio today. Frank Cogan is a national gay rights activist. He's worked in this area for many decades. He works locally with BCAP, Boulder County AIDS Project. He's on the board of Out Boulder. And right now he's in our studio. Good morning, Frank. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Also joining us, Jackie Hibbard, who is a hospice chaplain with Halcyon Hospice. She's also a UCC minister. She's also our guest this morning. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, we'll start with you, Frank. You know, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that we need to be paying attention to end-of-life issues on the LGBTQ community?
Oh, absolutely. I think that one of the most relevant things is that the generation that is today starting to face these issues, for gay men at least, many of us maybe never thought that we'd get this far. There was a time in the 70s and 80s when coming out meant you were admitting to your family that you might die soon. That was the biggest fear everyone had when you came out, was, oh my God, are you going to get AIDS? You're going to die. And I was living in New York in the 90s, and a lot of my friends were in that position, and you got diagnosed, and one of the very first things people did was sell their life insurance policies and move to Palm Springs and Fort Lauderdale because they thought they were going to have a year to live. And a lot of them, sure enough, did pass away quickly, but then the meds got better, and a large proportion of these people did not pass away, and their life insurance policies were gone. They had spent their money like they didn't think they were going to live any longer, and some of those people are still around today and are pretty frustrated that they that their aging plans had been interrupted that way. You know, there was something sort of freeing about thinking that we were never going to get old. You know, we were never going to age. We were always going to look great and stay young. And that didn't happen for a lot of people. So I think now the thing that happened, I think, that was most significant is that is what built the bridge between the gay men and the lesbian population. You know, the people that were at bedsides, a lot of them were our lesbian sisters who were there for us and weren't directly affected in the sense that they weren't carrying the disease. And, you know, the rates of infection among lesbians is way, 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 way lower. If you knew a gay guy, though, you knew at least one or two or three. There was a funeral a week for a while there. So though we probably faced a lot of death in those days, the idea that it would ever happen to us, for some reason it seemed very surreal. And now these are the people who are facing cholesterol and high blood pressure and, you know, getting cancer that isn't even related to HIV, and it's not something we ever really mentally prepared ourselves for.
That's so interesting. I had that exact same conversation with a friend just a couple of months ago who said, we were all in the mindset that we were going to die. Now we're not in the mindset that we're aging and that we're living, but in these aging bodies. And that's a huge psychological barrier to get over for so many people.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that in general, this generation that's aging right now, I just turned 51, myself and the folks maybe 10 or 15 years older, we're just old enough to not necessarily have all that family support. The tendency towards isolation is pretty high, and a lot of us also participated in pretty unhealthy behaviors back in the day because those were coping skills, you know. We try to stay away from those things, which often means staying away from the community because that can be a little bit unhealthy sometimes. So a lot of these folks are alone, and that is a rough way to age and to die, is by yourself.
And we're going to talk a lot more about the support services that are now available. Now that people are talking more about this and acknowledging the fact that we're getting older and we're going to die, and what does that mean? There are so many legal issues to also delve into as well, particularly with partners and, you know, people who are in non-traditional families. But I'd like to bring in our next guest, and that is Jackie Hibbard. Now, you're a hospice chaplain, so you are one of those people that sits at the bedside. I mean, take us back to your involvement in all of this and when you first started to get involved. Mm.
You know, I worked in the 90s at Project Angel Heart in Denver, where we were serving meals to the population that we're talking about, people living with AIDS at the time, and no idea that what was going to happen. Were they living? Were they dying? So that's really how I got introduced to end of life, and certainly lost my fair share of gay male friends. And I have some who are still living, and miracles, really, diagnosed in the 80s, and no real good reason why they're still with us. So that's really how I got into end of life, and I've been in hospice since 2005, and have definitely sat at the bedside with gays and lesbians. I've had two experiences working with transgendered folks, and a whole different challenge for them at end of life and seeking good hospice care and good end of life care. One of them was in a nursing home, not a great experience. The other one at home, very good experience. So I think it all is dependent on where people are and how welcoming and accepting and hospitable the healthcare providers are.
We do a lot of discussion on these shows that the end of life is so different for each person, but it can always be a little bit easier, at mm-hmm. least for your loved ones, if there's some type of planning or at least an acknowledgement mm-hmm. that this is where we're heading. And if that planning could be done before you're in a crisis health situation. But for many people then at the end of your life, and this is for everybody in society, you could be dealing with family issues and estrangement, issues that have not been dealt with throughout your entire life, and that can be amplified even further for people in the LGBTQ community. So do you often see that kind of existential crisis happening, or maybe on the flip side, deathbed, you know, reconciliation with family or people who had been estranged in the past?
Absolutely. I've seen all of that. I'd say a lot of LGBTQ folks have spiritual concerns that I want to talk about, or very unresolved, because quite honestly, the church has not been friendly to the GLBT community. And so lots of stories I've heard about awful things that happened in childhood and teenage years and young adulthood about being estranged from this community that was so helpful at one time. And then when you come out, or someone figures it out or outs you, it's not so helpful. And so I've done a lot of listening at the bedside with folks like that. Family issues, certainly, reconciliation or not. I've unfortunately known people who've never been able to reconcile with their family. And so then they die, and there's who's there to care for them? Well, the hospice team, fortunately. And people have been willing to step in and take people's ashes. And, you know, we've had those conversations about what they want to do with their ashes after they die. So, yeah, I mean, it's existential stuff just like everybody else, but amplified for certain.
We're speaking about end-of-life issues pertaining to the LGBTQ community this morning on KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran. My co-host, as always in this series, is Kim Mooney, who has been an educator in all of these issues as a thanatologist. It's hard for me with my Irish accent. There's too many THs in that word. But she's a thanatologist, and so she does a lot of end-of-life and death education, and her website is practically-dying.com. And we have two guests joining us in the studio today, Frank Cogan and Jackie Hibbert, who have a long history of working in this issue. And so much of it, as I'm sure we're going to hear when we get calls coming in, going back to the AIDS crisis that happened in the 1980s. Well, Frank, how did that really change things in terms of the gay community in talking about death? Did this launch a whole movement of acknowledging mortality, do you think?
Not just launching the idea of mortality, but I think it had a lot to do with why the gay rights movement took off the way it did. It was very galvanizing to have this gigantic issue, which is that this population was dying off, and people were there were lots of people who were outed because they got sick. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a friend who you have no idea is gay, and then all of a sudden they start to get really skinny, and they're getting ill, and then there's another one, and another one, and another one, and, you know, all of a sudden there was this community that was dying off, literally. I was in San Francisco in the late 80s, and there, it wasn't rainbow bunting on Castro Avenue, it was, you know, black bunting, and it was awful, and I think it brought everybody together, and it was the very first time that, oftentimes, when a population becomes threatened, that's when they become noticed, luckily. In this case, I think that's really true of the gay community. That's where I think the movement really started. And it's interesting that we've been able to move past where being gay doesn't mean you're going to die, and that there were so many populations who are also part of our rainbow that weren't faced with that. And it brought everybody together for the first time, I think. And it's interesting, I was part of God's Love We Deliver in New York, which was the Project Angel Heart of Manhattan, and I remember having the exact same experience as you do, and there were a couple times where I climbed up the steps, you know, of a brownstone to deliver food to somebody, and they were gone.
That's right.
That's how you found out, you know. Mm-hmm. There was no Facebook. You didn't find out somebody was sick because someone posted, you know, thoughts and prayers for this person, or someone, you know, posted that, you know, please join me in my grief. You found out because you knocked on somebody's door and they didn't answer. Mm-hmm. And you didn't get to give them their meal.
Can you tell me what rainbow bunting as opposed to black bunting means?
Sure. I mean, I was just in San Francisco a few weeks ago, and when you walk down Castro, there's a gigantic rainbow flag flying on the top of the hill, and there's, you know, rainbow bunting on every building, and it's all about gay pride. And in the late 80s, that's not what it looked like. In the late 80s, it was a very somber, you know, there was, you know, funeral processions, and there were community leaders that were dying, and it wasn't, you know, it was the same era where Harvey Milk was killed, and there was a lot of, you know, suffering. And I think that was a big thing to get past, was the fact that this sexual identity meant so much, you know, grief and pain. For so many people.
In terms of the reaction of the medical community at that time, I mean, were people getting treatment in hospitals? Were people getting specialized treatment? Or were people ultimately dying at home? You mentioned walking up the steps of a brownstone to find that the person was gone. I mean, what was the kind of the physical reality in terms of what spaces were made available to help people back then?
Well, there wasn't a whole lot of attention given to the crisis at all. In fact, a lot of what created awareness was ACT UP filling that space. That's what created all that awareness, was that the community leaders, and many of them were sick themselves, decided to make some noise and make sure everybody realized this was going on, because we knew it was happening in Manhattan, and we knew it was happening in the Castro, and we knew it was happening in West Hollywood, but I don't think there was a whole lot of awareness of that going on, and certainly not in rural Wyoming, and I doubt in parts of Colorado as well, where there weren't big communities that identified, and people didn't feel safe. People didn't stand up and say, hey, I'm a gay guy. Mm-hmm. And if they did, the only people that usually knew were their lesbian friends. Mm-hmm. And the women were there, and I think the women grabbed that baton and ran with it, because so many of them lost close friends. Because for the lesbians, it was the same thing. A lot of them didn't have family or friends that knew, other than the other gay people that they knew.
And the reality in the 80s and 90s, for a lot of LGBT folks, you couldn't be out and have a rental house or apartment because you could be kicked out. And so we had to be very anonymous. You couldn't wear Project Angel Heart pins or stickers, in the beginning, because we didn't want to out someone accidentally and have them lose their housing. And that was a reality.
So this was all back in the 80s, and thank goodness we've all moved quite a long way from there. But the reality, it's not all, happiness and light for everybody nowadays. I mean, what does the end of life look like today for the vast majority of the LGBTQ community? And particularly if we look at, not untimely death or young people, but older people now who are coming to the end of their lives now, 30 years after they lived through all of that. What are the ongoing challenges, say?
I think, and I'd love to hear your point of view from people you've been at bedside with, but I know those of us that are long-term survivors, I've had HIV for over 30 years, and for long-term survivors, there's a whole set of things that are actually a result of the meds. The meds got better, but, I've been on 12 different regimens now, and there's accelerated osteoporosis and bone density issues. Your resistance to antibiotics means that, you can catch something next week, and if the one antibiotic that's left that you're able to take doesn't take care of it, then you've got something that is the end. And that's along with all the other stuff that comes with getting older. So a lot of us didn't take great care of ourselves, and we didn't eat lean fish, and we didn't eat a lot of salads, and heart disease is a gigantic issue.
And as you said, there was a lot of risky behavior as a coping method, smoking, maybe drug taking or
sure.
alcohol or drug abuse.
And that's true across, I think, the entire LGBTQ population. I mean, that's not just gay guys who turn to those things. I mean, that was sort of what a lot of people did in order to deal, or you just isolated and stayed by yourself. There wasn't a big community of people acting out in healthy ways to cope with that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what I would add is in hospice, we work with a lot of people who live in long-term care communities, whether it's assisted livings or independent livings or skilled nursing facilities. And personally, as a lesbian, it scares the pants off of me to think about what it will be like if the time comes that I have to be in a skilled nursing facility as a lesbian, and how someone will treat me. And how will someone accept my wife? And that's reality. And when I would encourage anyone interested in hospice to do interviews before you choose a hospice provider, palliative care provider, to see how will you treat me? Will you accept my wife? Will you accept my husband? Will you, if I'm transgender, are you going to call me by my chosen gender identity? I said earlier that the very first transgender person I worked with in hospice was a woman, except when he went to the nursing home, he was a man. Mm-hmm. And it was awful because the hospice team would call her by her name But when we talked to the skilled nursing facility, they wouldn't know who we were talking about unless we used his birth name. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's offensive and hurtful and confusing, especially as people get closer to the end of life. And, you know, they're doing all this processing and their brains aren't functioning the way our brains function. And it was a really difficult, sad situation. And that is reality.
In terms of that, do skilled nursing care facilities, particularly around end-of-life hospice facilities, do they have a statement and a policy about that? I mean, is this something that needs to be brought in where people need to make a statement? As we see about, you know, religious preferences, mm-hmm. your religious preference will be accepted and honoured here. Are we seeing the same thing around gender identity, sexual orientation? And is this something that legally we could make, you know, organizations take a stand on?
Such a great question. Kim can probably speak to it as well. But I would say that most hospices and palliative care providers absolutely will have a statement including sexual orientation and identity, hospital systems as well. And I'm guessing more and more nursing home systems. And then there's the reality of the people at the bedside taking care of you and what that's really like. Because you can have a great statement, but if we've not done the education with our staff, it's only lip service.
Policy alone goes exactly, so far unless you change the culture. Yeah. I mean, Frank, what are your thoughts on this? And what have you seen out there in different facilities that you might have encountered people at the end of their life?
Well, I've gone back and seen people that I knew way back in the day who had great experiences, but those are folks that are in those places that I described as sort of the meccas for gay aging and dying. I imagine that the sort of paradigm that you're talking about is much easier to find in Wilton Manors, Florida, or Palm Springs, California. Places like Boulder, where we have a smaller population, I imagine that there's also, in those bigger cities, you're also going to find hospice nurses and care facilities that might be completely gay. Mm-hmm. There's old age homes in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. They're just gay old age homes, and there's, you know, probably hospice services that just deal with that population. So those issues don't exist. But in smaller places, smaller communities, that's going to be a gigantic issue, I imagine. Mm-hmm. You know, ideally, if you could find a gay or lesbian hospice nurse, that would be the way to go. There's one right there. But I think in the folks that are likely to be isolated are probably people living in places that are isolating, mm-hmm. places that there is a lower population density. And unfortunately, that ends up being a function of our commercial society. You know, the population needs to be large enough to be seen as a viable profit center in order to put in services that are dedicated to that kind of population.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're on the board of Out Boulder. Are we seeing more groups that, you know, LGBTQ advocacy organizations paying attention to these issues as we are having, you know, an aging population across the board?
Absolutely. Up in Longmont on Wednesdays, we have a community cafe that is nothing but 50 and older LGBTQ community. And one of the largest cadre there is actually the transgender population, because that's where a lot of the unknowns are. The idea of what hormone replacement therapy means way, way down the road, you know, that's a really tricky chemistry equation. So there's a lot of conversations among that population of what are you going through? What does this feel like? What does that feel like? You know, does that end up affecting end of life? And apparently there's a huge amount of fear and anxiety. I know that a lot of the people that come to that group also go to the death cafes. Mm-hmm. And the most encouraging thing is that people are talking about it. This isn't something we even talked about 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So the fact that the conversation's happening has got to be a huge part of opening an awareness and hopefully being able to compile more data, have there be better research so that we at least know what the physical issues are. And that way the hospice care folks can take care of the emotional issues and the psychological issues that go along with it.
We're speaking about LGBTQ issues and how that pertains to the end of life. It's part of our ongoing series on end of life issues here at KGNU. Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm Maeve Conran. My co-host, as always in this series, is Kim Mooney. Find out about all of her death education works. Hosts a series of workshops in the community, practically-dying.com. And our two guests in studio, Frank Cogan, who is a longtime gay rights activist. He works with BCAP. He's on the board of Out Boulder. And also joining us, Jackie Hibbard, who's a hospice chaplain with Halcyon Hospice, also a UCC minister. And we'll be opening up the phone lines in a few minutes here, 303-442-4242. We've talked about the psychological, the emotional impact of this, some of the medical stuff. There's a whole legal web of pain out there as well for people as well. That, you know, we've talked about the legal complications around end-of-life decisions and decision-making. If you are an LGBTQ person, you may not have that traditional family support, maybe kids or an obvious person to have as your advocate at the end of life. Is this an issue that you're seeing as well and something that people are trying to deal with? Kim Mooney.
Yeah, I do a lot of advanced care planning with people. And while we see a lot of populations that are working, that are using intentional family more than they are family of origin at my age, a lot of single women, this is particularly important for this community that we designate our advocates, it's a great word, not just a healthcare agent, our advocates to be able to walk us through a medical system. It's often important to have more than one if you can, and they don't have to be gay, they can be hospice or hospital staff, but to have two or three people, if possible, who can actually help you navigate that system just so you feel like you have mini community. In advanced care planning, Colorado is unique, yay, in that we're not a state where family automatically has the hierarchy in terms of who your agents are, or how your family works, your intentional or your family of origin, and you actually can designate, and it's set up so that your family not only has hierarchy, but you make the decisions. Any decision you make is more important than any surrogates. We have extra forms and special forms for body disposition and who can visit you in the hospital, and while they're not necessary, it's just another statement that is made about, you know, how you can be cared for. You know, I want to go back and say one thing that Jackie, I know is true in most hospices, is with any situation, if it's a good hospice, if for any reason you have an objection, you don't feel like you can truly serve a patient, they just move you off the team. And so the idea with these people who are not afraid of death and who are willing to work with all these issues is to create the best environment for that patient so that you won't have somebody working with you. We also have two incredible resources in Boulder County. There's an award-winning project called Project Visibility, and it was put together by the county. But any business at all, and every hospice I know has gone through this, they will come in and do a presentation about how to be culturally sensitive and how to work with people in the gay community. And they also put out a book, and I'm going to forget the name of it, so apologies, that lists gay-friendly businesses. So it's a nice resource to start with. Some of the hospices, some of the attorneys, that's another thing, is to work with either a gay or a gay-friendly attorney when you're putting together your estate is really important because they're going to start with the issues they know are important.
And, you know, we're dealing with the reality now, and particularly, say, with the transgender community. I mean, we're still debating whether or not birth certificates can be changed legally. What are some of the legal rights? This is, you know, just while you're living, let alone when you get to the end of your life. And the basic dignity of being called by your chosen pronoun and to be identified in the gender that you want to be identified in. I mean, is that a widespread problem, Jackie? Because you did mention there was a certain situation where, you know, the facility was just insistent on doing it their way and not respecting the wishes of the transgender resident.
Yeah, I think it just really varies. And in that particular case, it was painful to watch and painful to participate in. And thankfully, our staff was, you know, right there with her and supporting her all the way. And so, you know, she had a really good death. But it was difficult for certain. So to say if it's widespread, I don't know. I can tell you there's a really great film coming out, produced here in Boulder, called Tomorrow Never Knows, produced by Darcy Myers, a local person, and several other folks, but really following a transgender woman and her partner who, you know, going through Alzheimer's at end of life and all the struggles. So that should be coming out here in Boulder, I think, in the fall, premiering soon in England, but really great film. And I think that's going to shed a lot of light on end-of-life issues for the transgendered community.
Frank, we were talking about some of the legal concerns. And, you know, with an older LGBTQ community, there may not be children involved. There might not be direct family that you're born into who could be your advocate. Is this something that you're hearing at the various different support groups and the salons that you're hosting?
Absolutely. And one of the things that's bringing people to these groups is trying to find somebody who could be their advocate, who could be their final decision maker. And what we hope to do is create some friendships and bonds where people can be introduced to folks who can act in that capacity, maybe even a cooperative. You meet somebody new and you get to know them and they get to be your advocate and you get to be their advocate. It's, you know, some of these people have never had any sort of bonds like that. I'm lucky enough that I've stayed close to friends from high school and college, and I have a great long list of people that'll be there for me, and none of them are family. But a lot of people feel really, really isolated, and we start conversations about how their next door neighbor hates them, and it's a very long, torturous path from feeling that isolated, like your next door neighbor has something against you, to get into the point where you can find somebody else who's in the community that'll advocate for you, that'll take care of your final decisions. And it's a really interesting process, especially for people. And what we try to make apparent is that this population has an unbelievable well of strength inside of them that they may not recognize. Having lived a total dual life for a long time, many of us, in going back to preschool, may have known that we were gay and maintained a completely different persona well into our 20s or 30s. And one of the things I love to do is point that out to an older LGBTQ person and have them realize, wow, you're right. I have some amazing gifts. I am a strong person. Mm-hmm. I got through all that, and I can get through this too.
Kim Mooney.
Well, I want to add to that that the idea of coming out for your whole life, you know, in first grade, whatever, and then particularly at end of life, and not knowing with every new health provider whether you're going to be accepted when you are really invulnerable. One of the most beautiful things I've heard, because I don't think you come out and then it's fine. You're over the line and your life is fine. And people at end of life, when they're looking back and doing life review, often both grieve and recognize how strong they were in each part of their life and how hard it was to keep proving who you were. But a beautiful funeral for I think it was a transsexual. I can't remember what his or her name was, honestly. But his life had been so confusing to him that the service was written for him and her. Mm. And so at some points they would reference her, and at some points they would reference him at his request. And I thought that was a lovely way for him to acknowledge all the different pieces of his life.
Well, I'd like to open up the phone lines if anybody is listening and they'd like to weigh in, maybe ask a question, make a comment. The number is 303-442-4242, 303-442-4242. Our guests in studio are Jackie Hibbard, who's a hospice chaplain with Halcyon Hospice, also a UCC minister, Frank Cogan, who's on the board of Out Boulder, works with BCAP and has been a gay rights activist nationally for many decades, my co-host Kim Mooney, a thanatologist. That'll roll off my tongue easier soon. And her website is practically-dying.com. Once again, 303-442-4242. We've spoken a lot about the over-prejudice that people can experience, you know, not being identified by their chosen pronoun or their chosen name, or partners not being allowed to, you know, be with them in an end-of-life situation. But there's a lot of subtle prejudice that happens out there in communities like this that we pride ourselves on being incredibly open. We all need to be educated. I mean, what are some of the subtle prejudices that you see in this particular context of end of life that, you know, we really all need to be more aware of? Frank?
That's a great question. BCAP does free HIV testing a couple times a month up in Longmont at a Walgreens on Main Street. And Longmont is an interesting place. There's a significantly older population up there, I think, than in the rest of Boulder County. I've never seen the statistics, but I know from driving down the street that there's a lot of old people up there. And when we're doing testing, a lot of times the older folks will come in to fill their prescriptions that are for, you know, traditional older issues. And they're extremely uncomfortable when they see our table that's set up. And we talk about HIV testing. And, you know, I had a woman say to me once, it was maybe a month back, that she really wished that that was something she had to worry about, but it had been a long time since she would have had any contact that that would have been an issue. And it was really interesting because a lot of times they just will ignore and they won't even look at the table, and it's a very, very uncomfortable issue. And that might either be because they're still uncomfortable with the idea of sexual identity in general, or maybe they have a story in their past. Mm-hmm. They knew somebody who passed away, and it's just not something that they've coped with. And it's interesting. I think that is, I think for the population that isn't LGBTQ, this is also difficult. Mm-hmm. I think there are people, straight people, who when older gay folks pass on, they may have some unresolved stuff of their own, that they would never really reached out to this person, they never connected with this person, they never really got comfortable with this person's identity. So it's not just the person who's dying, I think. There's a huge, and I'm sure, Jackie, you must mm-hmm. have this experience all the time, that people show up and they're like, what do I do now? I waited too long.
Or they never came out.
Yeah. Or they never came out.
Yeah. But Jackie, what are some of the more subtle forms of prejudice that you've seen by the bedside or in, you know, some of the, even institutions like nursing homes or end-of-life facilities that think they have this down and they have a policy and everyone is trained on this, but you're still seeing some issues?
I'll speak from my own experience. Assumptions. Like when you go to a healthcare provider as a lesbian and they go through all those demographic questions, probably happens to you too, Frank. Are you married? Yes. Well, the automatic assumption is that I'm married to a man. And, what's your husband's name? What does your husband do? And then there's that uncomfortable moment, right? Am I safe to come out? And I always do, but there is that, ugh. So I think really it's those subtle assumptions that you see a man, he's going to be married to a woman. You see a woman, she's going to be married to a man. And that's not always the case. I think sometimes that's the most subtle of the discrimination that people experience.
And that sounds like that goes back even to the form that medical practitioners are working off. I mean, let alone their own personal potential biases, the actual system itself.
Absolutely. And, you know, forms haven't been necessarily in every health system evolved into, you know, I can't even tell you that last time in a healthcare system I saw transgender even as an option. Mm-hmm. It's now an option in our electronic medical record, but it wasn't. Mm-hmm. That's real.
Well, we'll go to the phones now, and I'd like to welcome Larry, who's actually calling in from Pennsylvania. Larry, you're listening at kgnu.org, but you're live on the air this morning. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. One thing I was wondering while I was listening was, while you folks spoke of, you know, different communities, maybe in Florida or San Francisco, having, you know, larger populations, there certainly are places where people are aging, and wherever they live, the folks treating them in facilities are not as well versed in how their situation with HIV affects their treatment. So they might look at them and say, okay, this person is older and they're towards the end of their life dealing with whatever disease that we see all the time, but how is that affected by their other condition that they may not see that often? And how that, you know, how that affects overall the fact that you may not be able to get care by somebody who sees a case like this regularly or often or at all.
Good question, Larry. Frank, do you want to respond to that one?
Sure. I think one of the biggest issues, and I think it makes people probably shy away from even seeking treatment because they're concerned about whether they'll be able to find a medical practitioner that understands all the different interactions. In small places where you might end up in a hospital room and there's, you know, they've never dealt with anybody with some of the conditions that you've got. And I imagine in Jackie, in hospice nursing, that must happen also in less populous places where a hospice nurse might end up. You may have even had an anecdote where someone dealt with their very first LGBTQ client and that had never known any of the specific issues that would be relevant. Mm-hmm. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think that happens occasionally. And then it's up to the hospice provider to provide education. So we recently had a patient who was in his 60s and not out to his family at all, living with HIV and end-stage AIDS, and not out to his family. And I had to do a lot of education with the rest of the staff about, okay, so you know he's gay, but when his family is around, this is the reality that you have to not out him. And I know that's going to be hard. I know, blah, blah, blah. Some of his family didn't even know he had AIDS. So again, we had to be really careful, and we did a lot of education with the staff around what you can and can't say. So, I mean, I think that's up to the hospice provider, but also, you know, thank God we made it safe enough for him to talk to us about it so that we knew that his family didn't know and that he wasn't out at all. I mean, that's took a lot of vulnerability and courage.
Mm-hmm. Well, Larry, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
And Larry called in at 303-442-4242. We have about 15 minutes left this morning on this topic here at KGNU. We're talking about the end of life reality for the LGBTQ community. Jackie Hibbard, who's a hospice chaplain, also a UCC minister, one of our guests, along with Frank Cogan, national gay rights activist for many years, works with BCAP on the board of Out Boulder. My co-host is Kim Mooney. Practically-dying.com is her website. There's a lot of resources on there for all of these topics that we deal with in this series. And I'm Maeve Conran at KGNU. And in the last 15 minutes, we could squeeze in some more calls at 303-442-4242. Frank, earlier you talked about how, you know, with the AIDS crisis, you know, in the 1980s, so many people sold their life insurance and they just expected to die. They're still alive 30 mm-hmm. years later. Is there a financial reality that has really emerged because of what happened back then?
I absolutely believe so. When I watch TV and I see those commercials where they have these older heteronormative couples talking about how their kids are in their 40s now and they don't need their life insurance anymore and they're going to sell it, it's actually an ad for a company that buys life insurance policies. And it always reminds me that where that started was in the AIDS crisis, when guys would get their diagnosis and they'd be told, hey, you have 6 months, you have a year, whatever. And if you had taken the time to do some financial planning and you had a life insurance policy, yeah, you could sell it for pennies on the face value. And the fact that that sort of moved into the broader sphere as these baby boomers are aging, et cetera, it's always fascinating to me. And I always recognize the irony. The reality is that the kind of financial planning that you're talking about that occurs today, you know, a lesbian couple in their 20s adopts or has three kids, and they set up all the stuff. They set up college funds, and they set up life insurance policies, and they do all that. For gay men, that's not so common. I have some friends who've gone down that path and who have that sort of structure in place, but a lot of them haven't lived their lives that much differently in terms of rational financial planning today in their 50s than they were in their 20s when they were, you know, staying out all weekend and, you know, living the big gay life that the 80s and the 90s were sort of about. So the implication is that a lot of those people, since you didn't think you were going to make it to your 60s, you certainly weren't stashing money in a 401k or an IRA. I think that if you looked at it statistically, you'd see a lot of those folks are not as prepared. And the good news is that there are resources out there that people can connect with. If whether it's through BCAP or OUT or Rainbow Elders or the Boulder Aging Council.
Boulder Aging Area Agency.
Boulder Area Agency. There's a lot of ways that people can connect to some resources and at least get some basic planning and get some assistance so they can figure out how to navigate this stuff. I have friends, for instance, who are affected with HIV that weren't aware until I had a conversation with them that their ADAP, their AIDS Drug Assistance Program formulary, also included assistance for non-directly AIDS-related stuff. You can get your heart disease medication assisted on the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. It's called the formulary, which is a list of all the different drugs that your plan will cover, and it's not limited to just HIV stuff. A lot of the aging stuff is on there too. Statins are on there, and you know, so there's areas that people might not realize that they can get some assistance. The bigger scope stuff, if you're 60 or 65 and you look back and you don't have any financial tools in place, that's terrifying. And I'm sure it doesn't make it any more likely that people have some comfort going into this era.
Mm-hmm. Is wisdom being passed now from your generation to the younger LGBTQ community who don't have to necessarily deal with a lot of what you had to deal with when you were, say, in your 20s? I mean, is there a real conscious effort to educate the younger folks to say, you're going to live a long life and you need to think about what that looks like?
That's really interesting. There's this very curious dynamic between LGBTQ folks that are 50 and older and, say, someone in their 20s. Sometimes I find it personally difficult to connect with them because they take for granted these things that we really, 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 really struggled with. You know, when you were sitting at someone's bedside, you know, holding someone's hand while they died, for me to fast forward that in my head 30 years to where I'm going to be having a conversation with somebody about respecting a pronoun, those are really, really far apart things. And I could not be happier that that's where we are. But I know a lot of older folks who really would love it if those 20-somethings would just say thank you. You know,
I think that goes beyond the LGBTQ community. Yeah.
I'm sure that's true.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left at 303-442-4242 is the number to call. And I do want to make sure that we get some information out to folks, because you mentioned there are a lot of resources in this local community on a variety of different issues. And Frank, you mentioned a few things that happen. There's the, you know, different support groups and meetups for older folks. Mm-hmm. Where can people find out when and where and all the details?
So from 11:30 to 1 on Wednesdays at out Boulder County's Longmont office, which is on Main Street, we have a community cafe that is older LGBTQ folks and allies also. We have allies who come, and they're very welcome, and often the ally voice is amazing to have there, both as supportive of the community but also curious about the community and finding out more, and that's how information is, you know, spread out there. I know online there's some great information on SAGE, which is the services for aging gay elders. And it talks a lot about what some of the issues are. And I think just finding out that there are other people who are confronting the same stuff that you are confronting can be really, really comforting. I think once someone goes through an experience with a hospice as a and meets a hospice caregiver for the first time, and maybe this is because they participate in the passing of someone that they're close to, that often, from what I hear, opens the door to discovering that maybe this won't be so terrifying. And that's how people introduced to hospice in the first place. So I think that Jackie giving some contact information about how you could get involved, I know some people that actually volunteer with hospice and get a tremendous amount of comfort and resolution for their own coming situation by helping people through it currently.
And Jackie Hibbard, you said that you really advise people to interview hospice, interview facilities. But what are the questions they should be asking? Because as we mentioned earlier, it's one thing to have a policy. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily playing out at a bedside.
Yeah, I think it's... I've gone through two interviews where people who are transgender have called and wanted to interview us. And some of the questions they asked were, I'm transgender. My pronoun is she. Will your staff call me by she? And my answer is always yes. So I think being bold and asking, being bold and saying, here's my issues. Are you set up to help me? I don't have any caregivers. I'm really going to need help figuring out what I'm going to do when I'm at the end of life. Are you set up to help with that? Is your staff trained in end of life issues for the LGBTQ community? I think that's a valid question to ask. How would you handle it if my wife is sitting at the bedside and I'm dying? Are you going to treat her like you would if it was my husband? So I think really being bold and asking the questions that are on your heart and mind, and it's taking charge of your care. And one of the things that our friends in the 80s, when they got AIDS and were dealing with the healthcare system, I think that's one of their legacies, is they became their own advocates. And then that legacy continues. And I think we all have to take that on and ask those hard questions and get the answers you want before you choose a provider.
And maybe, as we always try to advise people, don't wait until the very last minute when you're in that crisis situation.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, Kim Mooney, what resources, in addition, do you think are out there for folks? And particularly this area of, if you do not have somebody that's very obvious to you that you can have as a healthcare advocate. I mean, Frank, you made a really interesting comment about maybe we could set up cooperatives of this, you know, but how do you go about finding that beyond maybe showing up at one of the Outboulder meetings?
Well, he can answer that, but I think that's what you have to do. You have to intentionally move toward community that's going to support you. And as I said, Colorado is beautifully set up to not make the assumption that your family can, you know, show up. Certainly you can designate anybody, but setting up advocacy at the end of life, again, you want to work with people who can really drill down. I want to just say again, this isn't just because someone says they're gay friendly doesn't mean that they know what it's going to be like the first time they look at a transgendered body. I mean, when you, even in hospice, each one of these exposures. So working with a team that can actually say, okay, you know, we're setting up your estate. If your cousin shows up, do you want your cousin in there? I mean, breaking down not only family situations, but how do you feel about having your identity out? Are there places where you would like to not have it out? So I think that that's really important. I think in terms of advanced care planning that you, as you know, we've talked about this a lot, that you get it done far enough in advance, knowing that it might change, that you have a chance to explain it to everybody, to really go over it more than once so that they're all in your court, so that you know who your advocacy team is. And that's throughout everything, your financial planning, your medical planning. You know, make sure that your team is really on board ahead of time. And I have something I wanted to add in terms of prejudice, because I think this is what we forget. We overcompensate. Mm. When you meet a gay person and you want to make sure that they know that they're okay with you, you know, so they're a little friendlier or a little more supportive, or they want to make sure you come and sit with them so they can protect you. I see that go on a lot.
In a healthcare setting? Or
nah, in the healthcare setting, but even at parties, you know, it's just that little bit of overcompensation so they know that you're in their court. And so it really is a separation. Nobody's that extra nice to me. No.
Well, there's a pretty significant week coming up, and it is National Healthcare Decisions Week that starts April 16th through April 22nd. And this is a national event that people are encouraged to talk about these healthcare decisions and stuff. And as we said, the goal of this entire series is to maybe spark a conversation. Maybe somebody tonight over dinner can have that conversation, or at least start thinking about it. Where can they find out
more resources? Well, the Conversation Project, of which I'm also a part, is bringing Katie Butler here on April 18th. And she wrote a book called Knocking on Heaven's Door. And she has a very personal story about walking her father through the system and her mother through her death, too. I think the personal stories, as we were saying, are the ones that are going to change our relationship to all this. So sitting in the LGBTQ community, hearing each other talk about what the struggles are and what it really means to look for a healthcare agent are more important than anything we can say. If you get on the Conversation Project in Boulder County's website, they'll talk about the places where there will be presentations set up or tables set up to get more information. And the National Healthcare Decisions Day website also has a lot of information.
We'll put all of those links at kgnu.org, as well as to Outboulder and the various different groups that they host. But just, you know, talking about sharing your personal stories. I mean, Frank, for you now on a personal level, do you have all of this set in place? Do you have all of these decisions made? Because I feel that so often we talk about this and then I go home and it's like, I haven't done this myself.
I'm really lucky in that I have folks that are forcing me to be an adult. So they do say things to me like, you know, I know you think you're immortal, but you're not immortal, right? So you have done this and you have done that. So I'm lucky enough to have people around me that say these things to me. I think what is most interesting to me is finding out that there is stuff there that I didn't realize. Jackie, you mentioned that the religious area was not so supportive. And I am unbelievably touched to find out that that's not so much the case, especially here in Boulder anymore. UCC, for instance, B'nai Shalom is an unbelievably supportive Jewish congregation. There is some great spiritual and religious support that is available that I think if people had access to, that would calm them down a lot. It's mm-hmm. it's given me a tremendous amount of comfort to know that there isn't that sort of a distance that we kind of assumed was built in, some bias that we didn't know. And that might be some overcompensation. They may be working hard to clean up from
well, they have a lot of cleaning up to do in the past. Yeah. But Jackie, you're also a UCC mm-hmm. minister. And, you know, at the end of someone's life, that's very often when they rediscover religion or discover it for the first time. Are you seeing more faith organizations stepping into a place of consciousness around LGBTQ issues?
I absolutely think some of the progressive congregations absolutely are, the UCC, the Unitarians, some of the Jewish communities.
I want
to
give a shout out to the First United Methodist Church.
Yes,
in downtown
I was
Boulder.
Just going to do that mm-hmm. as well. They've been so supportive here for many, many, many years. So, but that's not every, right? So it's asking questions, it's looking for the rainbow symbol on church signs, it's going to websites and looking. But part of what the hospice chaplain's job is to, if that's something that's important for people at end of life, is to reconnect with their tradition or connect with a tradition. That's part of what we do. And for me, that's a real honor to listen to people's stories and help them really find meaning in their life, because really that's what we all want. What was our life about?
So I would like to make a plug, but also say this end of life piece is about recapping your life. A good advanced care planning, Frank, is documented on paper. and those conversations have been had in a way that the paperwork that you have reflects that meaning, reflects what your values are. So as you're moving through a dying process, nobody has to guess, and it's not hard to interpret. So I encourage everybody to do that. Mm-hmm. And on May 20th, I'm going to have a full-day advanced care planning workshop. And only a small piece of it is about the paperwork. The rest of it is about processing. Who have you been in your life and how you carry that through the rest of your life?
But we'll put links to your website, Kim, and all the other websites. We did have a caller, didn't want to go on air, but wanted more information about the cafe that you mentioned again. Frank, I believe that's the one that happens in Longmont.
Mm-hmm. That's on Wednesdays from 11:30 to 1 p.m. at 630 Main Street is out Boulder County's Longmont.
Right downtown.
Office, yep.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, but I would like to very much thank both of our guests in studio today. Frank Cogan on the board of Out Boulder. He works with BCAP and a longtime gay rights activist. Jackie Hibbard, who's a UCC minister and a hospice chaplain with Halcyon Hospice. As always, my co-host, Kim Mooney, who is a thanatologist. I will get that eventually. And her website is practically-dying.com. You can find all of our end of life programming, our series, the archives online at news.kgnu.org. Just do a search for end of life in that little search engine. We've done a lot of this coverage and we'll continue to do it as we embark into 2018 even further. And we will have more information about the conversation project coming up as we get closer to that date. That date as well. All the information online at kgnu.org. I'm Maeve Conran. You've been listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Stay tuned for the Morning Sound Alternative.